Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you enjoy the show, remember you can support it on Patreon at patreon.com/thephileasclub. This is how the show is financed, so if you enjoy it, please consider sending a couple of bucks our way. The link is in the show notes. Thank you. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 135. We're in October 2019, and we're talking about France, Germany, and the love that united us. Yeah, let's go with that. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This show is where we get together with different people from around the world and talk about things that have been happening and give you the takes from people who have different cultures and different opinions about stuff. And today it's going to be, it is a regular show, not a special where we cover one specific topic, but it's going to be a lighter show than usual because it's just the two of us. It's me, Patrick Beja, from Finland, although I'm French, and him, Matthias. I don't remember if we say your full name on the show. Matthias Keller, it's fine. From Germany, just the two of us.
Hello, everyone. Do you want to sing this time?
I wanted to sing a little bit. Do you want to like
sing?
Yeah, just the two of us. Just the two of us. We can make it if we try.
I'm not sure you want me to sing.
Okay, never mind.
Everyone will just turn off the show right
you
now.
You and then. I. Okay, I was a little bit off key there. But you know what? This is a great metaphor for where we are right now. Checking in with the EU. It's essentially just the two of us. The Franco-German couple, as we call it in France. We say le couple franco-allemand. Do you say that in Germany at all?
Not as a couple, but there is a special relationship, I guess. The French-German relationship, I don't know.
So from the French side, we made it official. And you're like, I don't know if we're ready to take it that far.
Well, maybe we need marriage counseling right now anyway. So
that is true. That's exactly where we stand. So, we were talking a little bit before we started the show, and I think that's going to be interesting for people listening who might not have, historical knowledge of the French-German relationship. I was looking for a picture to illustrate the show on the website. And sometimes I put a little bit more thought into those, and sometimes I don't, because it's really just the people who go to the website who see them. But I found the famous picture of François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl holding hands in probably the 80s. We were saying probably the late 80s at a, I think it was a commemoration of the end of World War II. And it made me, so for those who don't know, Mitterrand was president of France, Kohl was chancellor of Germany, and Kohl was also like 2 feet taller than Mitterrand, so the picture is kind of weird looking, but it also made me instantly, I wouldn't say emotional, although maybe a little bit, because of what it symbolizes and represents over the course of the last century's history. I don't know if you have the same feelings about that picture and what it shows, but it's certainly something.
It kind of
something.
Symbolizes the same, yeah. But I think it wasn't for World War II, it was World War I. It was, recall correctly, it was for the Verdun Memorial, for World War I. And I think
it's possible.
I'm just Googling it right now, and I think it was 1984.
There you go.
So maybe it was for the start of the First World War. And since Verdun, so if you know history, you know Verdun was one of the bloodiest battles. Yeah. And that's a kind of a symbol for the animosity, the arch enemy, Germany and France in World War One. And
I say World War II because this is the one, of course, we remember a little bit more since it's closer. Although both are discussed pretty much equally. Maybe the second one is discussed more in international circles. I don't know. But it's essentially the animosity, as you said, between France and Germany. And the very deep and genuine friendship that has been created between the two countries over 30 or 40 years after the end of the Second World War, which was symbolized by this handholding. It was actively
sought after because there were a lot of initiatives and like the exchange programs, the youth exchange, and I don't know what it's called,
Erasmus in French, the student exchange in university.
Not just in university, but in general, like you have, and we have partner cities. Every German city has a partner city in France. And then there is this, going back to World War One and World War Two, the graveyards are attended by certain groups, and they use this to deepen the friendship between the German and French people. And then we have even more official acts, like, for example, now we have the German-French Brigade. We have a brigade made up of German and French soldiers stationed near the border, and those are, of course, more symbolic things, but they are actively worked on after World War II, and especially of World War One, I guess.
I think, so. Well, I mean, after World War One,
the experiences from World War One.
Right, because, yeah, I mean, the trench warfare was obviously the World War II was traumatic for everyone, but the trench warfare is deeply ingrained into the psyche of the French and German people in general. And maybe it's getting a little bit lost nowadays. I don't know if it was already not the entire population, but the scars of the land are, you know, replicated in our minds, and it's something that is still to this day, more than a century later, extremely present. I think it was there all the time before. Now it's when you think about it a little bit, when you stop and think about it a little bit, but it's kind of impossible to forget. And the point that you're making, I think, is incredibly important, that these things didn't occur naturally, like by themselves. They occurred because there was the political will and intent to make them occur. There was the fresh memory of those wars and the desire to make sure that that would not happen again, which I think people are taking for granted nowadays, you know, kids and alike.
You're right, because nowadays even the older politicians are a generation that hasn't lived through the Second World War, or if they did, they were small children. So the memories of the two world wars are not present in the mind of politicians and the general public anymore. Although right now World War One is again a hot topic because of the 100-year anniversary and a lot of, you know, documentaries and remembrance and events like that. So that's coming back to mind. But you're right, World War Two overshadows everything, especially in Germany for obvious reasons. And as you said, it was the attempt to make this never happen again, the political attempt. And also, if you think about it, I think no one really can imagine fighting a war against France nowadays in Germany, even if you are like one of those crazy warmonger, right wing, whatever. I think no one really thinks about starting a war with France of any countries. And apart from the obvious economic idiocracy that would be, I mean, with the EU and
the economic consequences. But you mean because we feel close to one another, is we don't think about starting
a war. I'm not sure if it's close to one another, but it's just you're seen as you're the neighbor. You don't really you can fight over
so like family political kind stuff, of.
But you don't start a war with them. Mm. It's not feasible anymore.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way here as well. It's we're too close. Like what. It's outside of the realm of rationality to start a war. It would be like, what? What are you talking about? It's like brothers fighting and then someone giving one of them a gun and saying, yeah, now shoot them. And like, what? No. What are you talking about? So, but
and especially if you're living in the border areas. I mean, that the border is still there on paper, but it's so fluid nowadays because everyone from France has come to Germany to shop and vice versa. And they often speak, at least in the border regions, both languages. So there isn't really a definitive line that separates us anymore.
Yeah. So good job, politicians, trying to make sure we don't die horribly in horrendous wars. Your influence is still felt today. How long until it all disintegrates? I don't know, but I would like to never have to find out and to keep Europe going and the EU going, if possible, because that is extremely helpful in that sense. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine that only 60 years ago we were literally at each other's throats. I remember thinking, I might have talked about it in this show, and then we'll move on to other topics. But I remember thinking when I was working at Blizzard in France, hanging out with German employees of the company that were working in France as well, and we were joking about Nazis and World War II, and just, you know, saying, oh, I can't remember what we were saying, but silly jokes about that. And at some point, we were struck by the fact that our grandparents, well, maybe not mine because I come from Lebanon, but, you know, the grandparents of people our age were very possibly killing each other in this war. Just it's not like 15 generations ago. It's one or two generations ago. And now it was a topic of conversation, light conversation and laughter even. That is an incredible achievement by the you know, political will of the post-war era. So anyway, that's always, and that picture is very memorable. If you want to check it out, go to frenchspin.com. It will be the illustration for this episode. Ah, all right. Well, that was a little bit hopeful. Want to bring down the mood?
Sure, why not? Because if you look at the news, it's not something that brightens your mood nowadays, I guess. For me, it's just whenever I look at the news, it's like I'm getting so tired of everything these days. And I mean, it's sad, but it's a constant stream of, I'm sorry, bullshit from all sides. And it feels, for me at least, it feels like we're discussing a lot of topics, but we're not actually discussing the problems, but we're all discussing in phony debates about superficial things, but not the real problems. Mm. And that's kind of tiresome, at least for me it is.
So what kind of things are you referring to?
I mean, it's a lot of stuff. From if you look on the international side, there's the constant stream of idiocracy from the US. Mm-hmm. Then there is, or at least it's not the US, of course, but it's the current administration. Then there's the constant madness from the UK with Brexit, and then you have all the domestic policies, and everything around us is starting to burn, kind of literally, if you go for climate change. And For the domestic side, we have the discussion about climate change and how to react to climate change. You have the horrible events in Halle, the right-wing attack on Jewish people. Then you have the superficial debate about freedom of speech, which is completely out of place but still raging. Then we have a lot of...
Why is there a debate about freedom of speech?
Mainly because the right wing is trying to victimize themselves and starting discussions about, oh, there is no freedom of speech anymore. We are not allowed to say anything anymore. And even moderate politicians now use that for their political gain or for their populist announcements and try to victimize themselves and start the discussion. Even, I mean, they say there is no freedom of speech, which is of course bullshit. And even more so if they're going on stage at a public event and saying we are not allowed to say things anymore, dude, you're literally on stage saying things like that. So there, of course, there is freedom of speech, but the problem is that a lot of people now face criticism, and that's what they mean by we are not allowed to say anymore, because you are now getting a reaction and people are opposed to your views and articulate that. And if you are the middle-aged white male, if a few years ago you could say anything without any consequences, and now you realize, well, if I say things like that, people are objecting to that and are giving counter arguments, and I don't like that, because a few years ago that didn't happen and I could say whatever I want. Now I can't. So that's mainly the issue, I think. And of course the tone in discussions. I mean, we all know that, especially online, people are I don't know if the unhinged is the right word, but the tone is getting rough. Everyone is insulting everyone instead of talking to each other. So that's also
part of
the problem.
But hasn't that been the case for a few years at least now? I wonder, I'm sure it's heating up possibly, but I wonder if this isn't you getting tired of it and as the part of the process, and hear me out, as part of the process of understanding how to live in this new reality, where if you go out and seek out things to be angry about, you find them 24/7, unlike, you know, a couple of decades ago when you had to wait for the 8 o'clock news to be frustrated and angry. And so, because I'm saying this because I kind of went through the same process of being angry at everything because it was being thrown in my face by Twitter and Facebook and 24-hour news, to kind of getting tired of all of this and having to triage, are there things that I should really be angry about and things that are just people talking? And, you know,
I know what you mean, and I think you're right that especially Twitter and Facebook and online social media online are exacerbating this, inflating this a bit, and it's not as bad, I guess, in the conversations you have on the street. But I was talking about this because this is a topic that has been discussed in media a lot lately, and there have also been a few court decisions which are on this topic and were very controversial. A lot of the journalists that are the embodiment, I guess, of the old white men. I mean, the conservative journalists in the old newspapers, the ones that were read like 10 years ago almost exclusively, who have now a lot of competition online, are complaining about that. So it's not more like not just me saying, oh, I see that more, but it's also the discussion in the public and in media, which I was referring to. So it's not just that I see that, but also something that has been a topic for a while now, especially with court decisions. Like, there was a very controversial one a few weeks ago where a politician, a woman who is a prominent politician in the Green Party, and she was trying to sue, if I recall correctly, there were insults thrown at her on Facebook. and she wanted to force Facebook to reveal the identity of the person so she could sue them for slander or whatever. And the court then made a very controversial decision that she has to live with that insults, because she is a politician, and the insults, even though they weren't really, were part of the discussion of her political views. So I'm sorry, there is a curse word coming out just as a reminder. They called her a dirty cunt, and the court says, well, calling a politician a dirty cunt is a way to discuss her political views. Like, what? And
I mean, I understand that that could be a frustrating decision, but then what do you do? Do you say you can't call people a cunt or an asshole or a, yeah, we're going to, you can imagine what other kinds of insults could be levied, but right? No, you can't say, I understand the logic behind it. You can't say, no, you can't say that, right? Or can you? Do you think we shouldn't be able to call people anything like that? Or is it
not
just
sure
that
if we need
the cunt word
in a civilized discussion? But apart from that, and
I mean,
the problem
really,
is
wait,
that...
wait, I want to challenge you on that. Are you saying that we could, we should ban people from calling other people cunts? Like, I understand it's a bad word. Maybe you don't want it to be aired on TV as they do in the US, or. I understand maybe it's a sexist word, so we don't want it. Like, the N-word can't be used anywhere in the U.S. especially. Do you think it should be that kind of level because cunt is a special kind of word?
Because No, not at all. I'm not saying you're not allowed to insult anybody, I guess. But again, that's a difference between someone, if you have listeners from the US right now, they'll be outraged because they have a different understanding or a different concept of free speech than we, in Europe, for example, have. Like, we have limits on free speech in the sense that you are not allowed to, for example, deny the Holocaust and stuff like that. That is allowed in the US, but it's punishable here in Germany, for example. Just there are limits. And the same goes for insults. So if I'm just doing that out of anger in the middle of a conversation, no one would say anything. But if there is a limit where the person I'm insulting can actually go to court over this in certain cases. And the problem here is that politicians are complaining that they get a lot more insults nowadays, even down to threats, and there have been a lot of death threats to
politicians. Okay, but that's different.
But it's part of the whole idea. So
the
tone
the,
in online discussion
court...
is getting rougher. And she was, and that was just the one case. And just to be clear, the insult they're using is translated something that is a bit more serious than just the cunt word, where every British person is now, why is cunt an insult? It's just what I call my buddy. So it's a little bit different in translation, just to be clear. But the decision was controversial because of the way the argument was by the court was made. And it's not the final decision, the final verdict, because there's another level, the next level. Of the courts will probably just make another ruling, and so that's not the end of it. But that was just a point where people are saying it's increasingly difficult for politicians, and especially women, because women are targeted more often than men in this case. And that also prevents a lot of people from seeking office, for example, or from going into political parties because they're afraid they're getting targeted. So that's...
Okay, I think that's a wider conversation than just seeking out someone's identity because they called you a cunt. And I'm sorry for repeating this word. I know it was going to be offensive to many people, and especially I think in the US, but we're talking about it in kind of a clinical academic way. So it's different from seeking out someone's identity for calling you a cunt online. I think even when you're saying there have been death threats, that also is a different matter. If there are death threats, then if the court said, no, that's fine, maybe I would have a different interpretation of it. And again, if you're talking about the general, the issue of the general climate of aggressivity against people, and especially politicians, and especially women, and probably especially you know, people of color and minorities, then yes, that is a problem that maybe we should try and look at how to fix. But it's a different issue than getting someone's name because they called you a cunt, is
The issue was there. I mean, there are legal precedences where you can actually do that. She was not making that because she was feeling she was having a bad day and now I'm going to get this guy. Because there are legal, you are legally allowed to sue someone if they insult you in a special way. That there are special criteria, so not every insult is punishable, but in extreme cases, and that's what the courts are for. I mean, they decide, is that legal or not? And she was trying to get such a ruling, but if she she needs the identity of the person to make this ruling. And that was the first step. And not that... this specific case is like something special or out of the ordinary, but it's just something that was high profile case. And again, I'm sorry, it loses a lot of this in the translation, and I'm not versed on all the words she was called. And it was just if I would read it again, it was very outrageous in a sense that even a lawyer said, what are the courts talking about? That's complete.
Okay, so it wasn't just essentially it wasn't just that she was
not even in political circles, but also in judicial circles. So justices were saying, our colleagues made a very strange ruling there, or the lawyer said, well, if that's the case, then, and they were also discussing it in academic circles. And as I said, it's just the first court that ruled like that. If the next instance in the next higher court will probably reverse the decision and make a new ruling. But there was just something that came to mind in this context. So it's not like that was something special they are talking about now. But,
Right. So it's not exactly equivalent to seeking someone's identity because they called you a cunt. It was worse than that and more
It was a lot worse and a very specific. And the problem was it came up. It was something she said in the 80s in Parliament. And it was taken a bit out of context to put her statement in a different perspective than she intended.
Okay, and, so there was some kind of libel element as well, I guess,
that wasn't the problem, but it was used to heat up the conversation and make her out to be a villain, and that led to a lot of insults from people who were outraged at her supposed statements. Okay. And that one thing led to another, and then the insults piled up, and the worst ones were the ones she was trying to get the identity to take them to court over that.
Okay.
So
it sounds more complex as usual, more complex than something.
And again, I'm sorry, but the translation, it loses a lot of it in the translation. And I'm not a legal expert, so I can't give you the correct translations for all the legal terms. So I'm sorry about that.
I'm not sure the legal experts would be the best. Maybe we need an English person with the subtleties of the English language for really horrible insults. But okay, so the general feeling is that you're tired of all the BS, and relate.
Just one thing that I think you discussed that a little bit in the last episode, because the ever recurring topic of climate change, and there were the very notable strikes in September, were Fridays for Future, for example, in Germany, and now Extinction Rebellion were protesting. And in the aftermath, or at the same time, our government presented their new climate package, which is supposedly the answer to climate change for Germany. So what we are planning to do to limit our CO2
emissions, yeah,
emissions, and what we are going to do to fight climate change. And the problem is everyone, like not only the activists, but also a lot of the politicians themselves said, well, that's just not enough. That would have been a nice package if it was like 30 years ago. But now at the current stage we're in, this is just not enough. That's not even a real attempt. That's just for show. And even then, a lot of the critics who not outright deny climate change but don't want to face it are saying even that is too much for the average citizen. They can't bear it. It's too costly for them. And it's just, we're not discussing the real issues. We're just creating new little battlefields around it to divert attention. And we're not getting to the point, to the core issue, really. And a lot of people, especially the young people who are actively trying to get a change in climate policy, are now frustrated because they see everyone is agreeing that there is the problem. There's actually no debate about the problem itself. And you're still not doing anything. Mm. What are we supposed to do if you're not listening to us?
And I think that's a common theme and a common thread where we're not debating really the core issue itself anymore. We're debating what to do about it, but everyone agrees about the core issue, like to an extent that hasn't been seen before. So, you know, maybe it's I would say baby steps, but the problem is, we have time for baby steps? Yeah, exactly.
So are people in France actually talking about climate change? What is France doing in this regard?
Well, that's the same issue as in Germany and every country. I think when you take a stance, when you look at it from a climate change perspective, which is the one that actually matters, then you should, you think of very drastic measures. But when you look at the economic and political realities that you have to contend with, then it's difficult to make those decisions in that way, especially since everyone has solutions as long as they don't impact them too much. And I include myself in this, probably. I don't know, but I think it's for example, I don't want to throw the gilets jaunes under the bus because I don't think that's fair, but the reason why the whole movement started, or the spark I should say, was that there was an increase in fuel costs through tax for climate change reasons, to incentivize the purchasing of fuel and pushing people towards more renewable sources of energy somehow. And of course, the Gilets jaunes are saying, well, it's very sweet and very cute that you think this is going to help, but what we really need to do is to create big shifts in industry, because this is where it really matters. And I think that's a fair piece of criticism. I'm not saying, you know, oh, the Gilets jaunes don't want to do anything that impacts them. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying everyone is looking at their neighbor to say, well, we could change that over there. But when it comes to me, it's just not tenable for me to change that, the thing I do like that, because what do you want me to do? And that's true. You know, if you tell people, well, you can't drive cars anymore, especially if you're not in the city, what do they do? It's the same for me. I live in the countryside. We looked at an electric car, but it just wasn't viable for distances alone. And so we bought a fuel car. And we didn't really have a choice if we wanted to get our son to daycare. So we're still, you know, we're hippies. So we're looking at geothermal heating and maybe at some point solar panels and stuff like that. But overall, and if you look at France, we don't even really have the problem of coal burning and stuff like that for electricity, because a long time ago,
nuclear.
Yes, we have nuclear power for 80% of our electricity. And we've had that for, you know, many decades. So, of course, nuclear has other issues, which, by the way, I watched the Bill Gates documentary on Netflix. And the last part is about modern nuclear plants. And oh my God, it looks like the solution to a big part of our problems. And maybe it was presented in a very positive light, but it seems like it's the best, maybe not perfect, but the best solution we would have for electricity. And it uses, like, it reuses spent enriched uranium rods discarded from other nuclear facilities. And it's modern in a way that is, like, it's the nuclear plants that we use now are, the best cases, designed in the 60s. And now, if we look at them how we would do them today, we can make them so much safer, so much less polluting, so much everything. And the reason, at least according to what they were saying in the documentary, and I don't think they're, you know, spinning it to make it look sexy. It's there. They have no point in, no interest in doing that. The reason we're not looking at that is because of the stigma of nuclear power, which all of the reasons for that stigma are not present in those more modern nuclear designs, nuclear power plant designs. And anyway, that's an aside. But it feels like a really tangible, creative solution to our problems that we could implement right now. And it wouldn't fix everything, but it would fix a lot. So I would encourage you to go check it out. And maybe we'll need to speak to a nuclear power plant scientist to get the real situation there. But to answer your question in less than the 15 minutes I just took, it is also a big discussion in France, and I think everywhere now, which is different from even 10 years ago.
But also something you said reminded me, easy solutions are good as long as they don't impact you. There is something, if we talk about the US, everyone is talking about guns and how stupid they are because they don't have gun control from a European perspective, to be a little bit exaggerated, but you know what I mean. The same thing goes for Germany if it comes to cars, because the worst thing you can do to a German, it seems, is to limit the speed on the highway. it's the same. It's the same kind of discussion, because everyone agrees, well, we should just limit speeds on the highway, on the autobahn, to something like 130 kph. That's reasonable for most other countries. Everyone around Germany, every country has a limit around 130 or 120 or 140. They all have limits. Just Germany doesn't have any. And if you suggest that there should be a limit, everyone in the, not just the industry, but also the guys who have the big cars are saying, well, you're taking away our freedom. Because it's freedom for me to drive 200 kph on the Autobahn.
For Americans, 130 kilometers per hour is about 80 miles an hour. So
it's kind of the same discussion. And everyone says, well, that is something that wouldn't really impact you, because even if you drive faster than 130, you won't save a lot of time in the long run. It might be a few minutes you get to the destination earlier, but nothing really significant in most cases. And it would really help the pollution, to bring down the pollution, for example. It's a simple measure, but still, that's freedom, you know. And there are really people who argue as if it was like the essential only freedom that only matters in this case, even though it's something, let's just say, rather mundane, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's not like 130 is
slow.
But
that's just the same kind of the same discussion you have in the US if you want to take guns away. And it was just something that reminded me, because it's kind of funny if we talk about the US and how, quote unquote, dumb they are if they discuss gun control. It's the same over here with cars. So
Well, I'm going to talk about something where I will also make a comparison with the US's right to bear arms, with religious, not freedom, the not the opposite, our lack of our secular government and tradition in France, because the latest debate to divide the country has been about the Islamic veil, once again. Although that's a little bit different. What happened, and I'm not 1,000% sure about the particulars of the case. It doesn't really matter what sparked it, but the debate started from what I can tell, a mother going to get their child at a school wearing the hijab, the Islamic veil, you know, the thing that covers the hair. And there was a Front National or Rassemblement National, a far right mayor or elected person there, another woman, I believe, or maybe it was a man, but they essentially told them that they shouldn't wear the veil when they are coming to school to get their child. Or maybe they were a nanny. So, again, as I said, I'm not 1,000% certain on the particulars, but essentially there was a woman who was wearing a veil who came to a school, and a far-right, a person elected from the far-right party told them, you shouldn't be here with your veil. And that sparked an entire conversation about the veil and whether or not women should be allowed to wear it in certain conditions in France, or to wear it at all. Like, the debate became a little bit widespread. Now, I a couple of things. First, I think it was that heated because the media and everyone jumped on it because there wasn't a lot of other hot topics to discuss. So it was a little bit like blown out of proportion. Obviously it was, but more than it would have been if there was actual things happening. And maybe some people will fight me on that, but I think it is the case. But also, I think it shows how, as you said about speed, we are very touchy on religion, things that show religion in the public. And some people will say, oh, well, you can wear a cross on your around your neck and that's fine. But if it's a veil, it's not. It's not. I think, you know, it there is to an extent, if someone came with to school, how can I explain this? A veil is a little bit more visible than, for example, Muslim symbol that you would wear on a necklace. That would not be a problem. So I just want to point that thing out. But we do have that obsession about making sure that we don't show religious signs as much as possible, especially in the context of school and the administration, in the same way that the Americans are attached to their guns, or apparently the Germans are attached to their crazy dangerous speeds on the highway. And I didn't used to see it like this. I thought I was in the camp of, no, it shouldn't be. You know, we should be very careful about religious symbols and make sure they are as forbidden as possible in the context of the state and the public administration. I don't think I would have gone as far as that person here, because like a woman outside of school, come on. But I have changed, I think, even my view on the veil because of my proximity with countries where it's not as much a problem, the UK, the US, and many others. And we tend to be hysterical, for lack of a better term, not quite hysterical, but I think it's fair to characterize it like this to an extent. We tend to be hysterical about these kinds of things. And I didn't see it like that at all. I would have seen it as a, yeah, let me put it like that. I think a few years ago, 5-10 years ago, I would have seen this as a genuine, valid question and discussion to have. I don't know that I would have fallen on one or the other side, but I would have thought, yeah, this is something we should discuss and decide because it's a reasonable thing to question. I think maybe it wouldn't have been the case and I would have not thought it was as important as that, but I think I would have. Today, I do see it as more, you know, more like a... something that shouldn't really be a debate, because I have gotten used to the idea that some, you know, religious signs are okay, and they are not going to, I don't know, like corrupt everyone else by virtue of proximity. I will point out, though, the debate on the burqa, which is the full thing that covers the face, I still think is valid, because in that instance, it is much more extreme and it is, I think, a vector of oppression for women. And even if they, you know, some of them say, well, I want to wear it, which is the entire question here about the hijab. Even if they say, I want to wear it, I think it ostracizes them and gives an image of women to men as something to be hidden. So that debate, which we had in France a couple of years ago, I think is still valid, and I'm not a big fan of the idea of the burqa. But the hijab, which is just, you know, a foulard, thing that covers your hair and neck, I am much less worried about. Now, if you talk about the full garb, maybe I'll be a little bit more skittish. I can't help it. I'm French and it bothers me a little bit more. It's a little bit too in your face, I guess. But just the veil, just the thing on your hair, I think it's that question is artificial, maybe? I don't know. I fall on the side of why are we making this into a big deal when I don't think it should be? And the worst part is that no one or very few people in the media who were discussing this were discussing this with women who were wearing it. You know, we didn't hear from them. We were just talking about them. And there were a couple of people who invited women who were wearing it to express themselves and explain. And I don't think they chose them specifically, because some of them were a little bit hostile in the media. But it seems that all of their explanations made a lot of sense. You know, it was just, yeah, I want to wear it. It's a way for me to live my faith. And it's not like I'm saying anyone should be forced to wear it, and certainly they shouldn't, and many in my family aren't as religious as I am, and blah, 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 and it's fine. And if you even, like, we're talking about these things going to extremes that are theoretical a lot of the time. And even when they happen, since they're not the majority, we can deal with those on an individual basis. And so we generalize these extremes to make conclusions that are themselves extreme. So that's my opinion on the thing, but I guess
that's a problem, not just on this topic, but on a lot of topics, because that's something you hear constantly as criticism for the political talk shows you have over here on TV, for example, that a lot of times, if you discuss a topic, especially the controversial ones, that you are discussing the topic, or it is discussed by people who are talking about them, but not talking with the people who are actually affected by it. But the first thing that came to mind when you just said that this is a topic, I was just thinking, again, because it's like a recurring theme for me. And I can remember that we had the same discussions. The two of us had the same discussions a few years ago about something similar.
No, and, but that's what I was talking about. It was about the burqa. And that's why I brought it up. Because the burqa to me is different. The burqa is the one that covers the face that they, you know, that they impose. It's not imposed probably in France, and the cases are very limited. Like it's a few handful of women in France that wear it, but it's the ones they impose in extreme Islamist regions, like extreme, like the You know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. And I remember that was the initial reason why we discussed this. But I remember, at least for us in Germany, we also noted the discussion because it was like something about women bathing on public beaches and then wearing the burqa or something was the initial one that made the news back then. And it
so there was a question. Sorry. Go ahead. You're saying it happened as a discussion because women were bathing in Germany?
I think that was... No, not in Germany. It was in France.
Okay, but, so in France what it was... Sorry, so just to specify what it was. What the debate turned to was that some women or men were wanted to have women-only days at the pool, or at least that's the part I remember, which I'm also not in favor of. You know, that is something that, again, is, I think, a valid debate. Wear a special bathing hijab if you want, or maybe even a full bathing suit that covers your entire body. We could even go there. But when the debate turns to, well, we should have women-only days at the pool, that I don't think is... a direction I want to go to. And I think that was the discussion.
Remember that this happened in France, and that turned into a discussion over here as well. But it wasn't limited to the burqa, but it was also extended to the whole hijab thing in general. And that's why I just thought about again, because for us it was like not just limited to the burqa, the discussion, but also the complete headscarf thing in general. And it's something that seems to be coming up in regular intervals, I guess. There is no definite solution. Like we can't seem to get on a solution for that. And it just pops up every now and then again, especially if someone is trying to wear a headscarf, for example, as a teacher. And then they try to get, this is a court case usually, and whenever a court decides it's allowed or not allowed, then it makes the news again.
So do you have the same kind of, because I thought Germany was a very Christian or Protestant country?
Protestant,
thank you. Do you have the same no religion at school? Kind of
in general, I guess yes, because church and state are separated, but it's kind of iffy in the sense, especially in conservative or Catholic regions, for example, Bavaria, schools have a lot of the time a cross in the classroom, for example, and a lot of people are arguing, well, if you display the cross, then why are you not allowing different symbols, for example, the hijab?
That's funny. In France, I think, I don't know, but I think the country would be thrown in a similar tizzy if someone brought up the idea of a cross in a classroom.
Yeah.
So even though we're more accepting of Christian religious symbols in society, I think if there was a cross in a classroom, people would get nuts as well. So at least there's some consistency there.
But again, that's not for the whole country, because again, especially in school matters, the different states are the important governing body. Education is a state responsibility, not for the whole country, but every state has different laws regarding education. And usually, if the courts decide, they usually say, well, if you are in a public office, for example, if you work in administration, public administration, or if you're a teacher, you're not allowed to wear a headscarf, or usually you shouldn't be allowed to display religious symbols. But in a lot of cases, they also say, well, why aren't you taking down the crosses as well? So it's a little bit difficult because you can't make a general statement for the whole country. But as a rule, I guess everyone tries to keep religious symbols out of school, unless you are in the conservative parts of the country, I guess.
I think maybe it's specifically for the headscarf that my opinion has shifted, but it might be because, you know, there's a lot of this that is about familiarity, like being used to something. And even in general pop culture products that are a little bit more inclusive, it might be as silly as the little illustrations I see on my kids' books and on, you know, material from the Social Security place. They always have like a meticulously diverse cast of people in the illustrations. Like, there's the slightly blacker person and the woman and the person with the scarf. And like, so it's, I'm just getting used to it, and I don't think anymore that this is an aggressive symbol of religious zealotry. I'm not saying I ever thought that specifically, but it seems to me it has become a little bit benign, and it might be because of comics where I see, you know, there's Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel, which is a Marvel character. She's a Muslim, so in her environment, there are people with hijabs and things like that. It might sound dumb, but I think it normalized this a little bit. This is a little bit of a tangent, but it's relevant on the normalizing aspect of things. Have you ever watched Billions, the TV show?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so it's on HBO, at least here in the Nordic region, on HBO Nordic. And it is a show about horrible people making lots of money on the stock market and horrible people trying to stop them as state attorneys. And it's an okay show. It's fun. But the thing that brings it to my mind now is that one of the characters is non-binary. They are called Taylor, and of course it comes up on the show in the first or second episode where they appear, and they say, you know, I'm Taylor, blah blah blah, and my preferred pronouns are they, them. Is it they, them? I guess.
Yes.
And you know, the people in the room look at each other and they're like, okay. And from that point on, they essentially make the entire show referring to Taylor as they or them. And it was weird at first. She is biologically a woman, or I guess there would be debate about people who are gender theorists on that, but the way I see it, the actress is a woman, let's put it like that. And it was weird. And for me, hearing entire conversations, as much as I've seen people putting in their Twitter bios, you know, their pronouns and stuff like that, for me, it was weird seeing or hearing entire conversations referring to someone as they or them. And I guess I got used to it through I binged it, so I saw like 4 seasons in a few weeks. And the character is really cool and they're interesting. And it just got me used to that idea. And I'm not completely, I don't want to say comfortable, but comfortable in the way that I'm not used to saying those words in that way. I'm not completely comfortable with that yet, but I'm getting more used to it because of the influence of that pop culture TV show. So it normalized it for me. And now it's like, at first it was a little bit shocking, you know, it's, okay, so that's how it works. It sounds strange. But now it's like, you know what? It really doesn't hurt anyone. They want to be called they? Fine. And in the show, they reference, I think there are two episodes in four seasons where they reference this. At some point, she has to dress differently and wear a wig to appear womanly. Or they have to dress differently and wear a wig to appear womanly and to be like a woman. And at some point, she has a discussion with her father, who also is having trouble calling them they. And he refers to them or her as a woman or she or her kid. I mean, his daughter or stuff like that. I guess daughter still. And then he corrects himself. He says, my child or whatever. But it really helped me normalize that idea to the point that I could think about it, I think, with a little bit more objectivity and not having the weight of my, not even preconceptions. That's not what it's about. My habits, you know? And I think that's a little bit of what we're talking about here as well. We have a habit of doing certain things. Maybe in the US it is, we need our guns. And maybe in France it is, we need to keep religion out of everything. And maybe in Germany it is, we need to go really, really fast on the highway. And here, it got me used to a thing. It normalized it. So I could not, that didn't decide what I thought about it, but it made sure that I could think about it rationally. And now that I think about it a little bit rationally, it's like, it doesn't hurt anyone, whatever. Sure, I can call you that if it makes you happy. Why not? Why would I deny you this? It honestly, I don't think it's going to change society. It's not, anyway, we could talk about non-binary and that issue in another episode. But as it relates to the hijab thing, I came from a place where I had the weight of my habits, and over the last few years, because of the normalization through proximity, I got to, okay, this doesn't seem like it's a crusade to convert everyone to Islam, and as religions go, this is a pretty mild way of adhering to the precepts. It's just wearing a scarf. And you know I love scarves, so sure. So anyway, that was a very long
guy. Getting back on the hijab thing, just something I'm interested in, because it's kind of interesting for us. We're talking about anti-Semitism again in Germany a lot these days. And when it comes to anti-Semitism, a lot of people point out, well, you should be allowed to wear a kippah, the Jewish head. What do you call it? The Jewish males
rabbi?
Wear the...
The rabbi?
No. Just a little cap everyone wears.
Oh, yeah, the kippah. Yeah.
Yeah, the kippah. And if you should be... A lot of people are pointing out you should be allowed to wear a kippah in public. And everyone should be free to do that without fear, because a lot of there are a lot of news stories. If you wear a kippah in the open, you are the target of anti-Semitism and hate, oftentimes. And it's interesting that a lot of the people who point out that this should be allowed and should be possible have a different stance on the headscarf thing, even though they're both religious symbols, but in one case they are allowed apparently to show that in public, and in the other case they're not. So I'm just interested, is there something similar in France as well? Is there a difference?
Well, I don't think we've quite had issues with the kippah, certainly not on the level of the headscarf, which, for the record, a kippah is a lot more discreet than a headscarf. But we certainly have in parts of France, I guess, but certainly Paris, Hasidic Jew communities, maybe not as extreme as Hasidic, but, you know, people who don't shave or who let their hair grow, including, the little twirly things on the sides, and who wear specific clothes. I don't think they're quite being... When the Jewish religion is discussed, it's usually as in the same context as it is in Germany, it seems, saying there's a you know, returning of anti-Semitism, and it shouldn't happen. Because there are more anti-Semitic acts. I don't know that I would say the same, you know, the people who advocate for against anti-Semitism are also people who have a different stance on the Islamic veil. I don't think so. I think people who are for religious symbols would probably be for both, but I don't know that to be a fact.
It was just something I thought about because you mentioned the differences between the religious symbols. Like, a lot of people are maybe more forgiving if you show Christian symbols than you if you do Muslim or Jewish symbols.
Well, Christian symbols for sure. I think France still, there are people who consider France to be No, I'll take the risk. France is more of a Christian country than, you know, traditionally it is. It has more Christian roots than other religions. The Jewish community has always been there, and, you know, as in many other countries, ostracized to an extent. And the prevalence of the Muslim community is more new, probably, you know, the last, I don't know, 100 years or so, maybe 50, 60 years after the Second World War. So there is a little bit of a different take maybe on the Jewish and Muslim communities. But I think the people who are for or against one specific thing would, on principle, be applying it to both Jewish and Muslims. Even if they don't quite believe, you know, if there are people who have a deep hatred of the Muslims somewhere, then they don't hate the Jews as much, they would say the same for both because that's how it should be for them. But they would make a different case for the Christian faith and symbols, I'm sure, justifying it by saying, well, France is a Christian country, right? Mm-hmm. That's the okay. Christian identity, I think.
Okay. But, yeah. Well, and right. Just for something a little more lighter, there's one thing I wanted to mention just for the laughter, I guess. Okay. If we are having so many problems down here, maybe we should just go into space, because we're now discussing if Germany should have a spaceport and if we should build one here in Germany. And it's something that is exploding on Twitter and Facebook, of course, because everyone is just shaking their heads and laughing about it. But
you mean a spaceport for private space travel, or
I'm not sure if it's private or not. It's the idea is someone from the industry, whoever that was, made a remark. There are so many people working in space-related industries over here, like building satellites, communication, and all these different parts. Well, if so many people are working in that industry, maybe we should do something for that industry and build our own spaceport so everyone will launch their satellites from Germany. And
it seems like the sky and the weather are not the best suited for that kind of activity.
Yeah, that too. And it's possible. I mean, a lot of the spaceports that launch satellites, for example, are near the equator because it's more energy efficient if you do that in the equator. But it's possible to do that from almost anywhere, I guess. Okay. But for some reason, they decided that should be a topic. And now we are discussing if we should build one. And our Minister of Economics said, well, we are going to check if that's possible and if we should consider that. And everyone says, even if that's a possibility, maybe we should think about that, because over here in Germany we are not very good with building huge projects, because we have a lot of failed public projects at the moment. Mm-hmm. We can't build airports, we can't build train stations, so why should we build a spaceport? But it's just something that made the news the other day, especially on social media. And I think I should mention it just for everyone to have a laugh, I guess.
Listen, I'm all for building spaceports in Germany. If we need to go out to space, I would much rather have to travel to Germany than to Caribbean country or territory. It's much farther. So as we will soon be able to travel to the moon and Mars, I think we need a spaceport in Europe. And if you don't want to build it, we have a lot of expertise as well. I'm sure we could create some kind of joint spaceport task force from the European space agencies with everyone from the EU and continue the tradition of working together to avoid future deadly conflicts. So let's do that.
Good idea.
Excellent. And on that note, we will bring the show to a close. Thank you so much, Matthias, for being with me and bringing a little bit of that Franco-German couple into the episode. Where can people find you on the internet if they want more of your musings?
If you want to talk to me or see what I'm ranting about online, you can always find me on Twitter. The handle is @Matzekult. And if you are using Mastodon, you can also find me under the same handle on the instance chaos.social.
Perfect. I will put the link to the Twitter account on the show notes. And for me, it's NotPatrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can find this show at FrenchSpin.com and support this show at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is in the show notes. If you enjoy it, if you think it's important, if you have fun listening, then maybe consider sending a couple of bucks our way. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you again in a few weeks. Bye.